This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Season 7, Episode 10 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we are beginning a new series, this one on J.J. Abrams. Now you may say, hey, you guys did a series on J.J. Abrams already, right?
Yes, and they would be outraged, and rightly so.
Well, that series was on J.J. Abrams' work as a director. However, in keeping with our Star Trek Beyond theme for the final season of Commentary Trek Stars and looking at the people who are working on Star Trek Beyond, we thought that it would be kind of interesting to look at J.J. Abrams through the lens of the job which he has on Star Trek Beyond, which is that of a producer. More specifically, a producer of a movie which he's not directing.
Yes.
So, especially since we've already covered all the movies that he produced that he did direct, obviously, in our series on him as a director, instead of repeating that, we decided to go with this. Because, you know, trailer starts up, you know, and it's like, from producer, J.J. Abrams. And it's like,
what? I always, as a quick side note, I hate it when trailers do that. Because, like, they really have started scraping the bottom of the barrel sometimes. And it just, you know, I get from the producer of or from the studio that brought you, but like they're so bad now. It's almost like from the caterers who worked on Twilight.
I mean, from the studio who brought you, I think is pretty terrible, because it's like,
yeah,
from the studio who brought you. I think the first time I saw it was Remember the Titans. I forget what the movie was, but it was one of their other sports movies, and it's like, from the studio that brought you Remember the Titans, and I'm like, but none of the people who worked on Remember the Titans worked on this thing, so that means literally nothing.
From the bank that mortgaged your house.
That's exactly what it is, you know? But in the case of a producer, especially a producer like J.J. Abrams, who has his own production company, who makes, you know, a certain type of movie, I guess, or maybe not, I guess we'll find out. It is kind of interesting. And, you know, I guess the question is, should people be excited? Because obviously J.J. Abrams is a name. You know, he's currently the director of what is about to become the highest grossing film of all time, right?
Domestic. We don't know about worldwide.
No, I
he's
think
still got a little bit to go worldwide.
I think worldwide is well on its way too. I was just looking at some number where it's like the It's made like twice as much as Avatar is made in the same amount of time.
Yeah, I actually have gotten a little bit of a kick out of, you know, every so often going over to Box Office Mojo.
Yeah.
And it's like, you look at the 14-day, you know, box office receipts and everything. It's like, my goodness. But I mean, even the question is longevity, because even Jurassic World was beating Avatar at this point.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah, wow. It was in terms of receipts, but Jurassic World sort of like just fit, you know, the candle which burns brightest burns half as long.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, will Force Awakens keep burning so brightly? Because both of Cameron's big wins, Titanic and Avatar, they were movies like they were released at this time when there was nothing. It was the graveyard.
And
that's why people kept going, yeah.
They lasted until March. I remember, like, I'll never forget this, like, because I was, you know, working as a projectionist when Avatar came out, and, you know, the files for the movies are encrypted, and, you know, when you get a movie, then you get a key which unlocks the movie for X amount of time, and usually it's like 2 weeks or something, and then if you're going to still be playing it, then they send you more keys to unlock them for longer periods of time. And for Avatar, the keys lasted until the end of March, which is insane. Like, no one ever does that. And I'm like, wow, that's wow. And then that rolled around, and sure enough, we actually needed new keys to extend it because we had the movie through the end of March. The movie outlasted those super duper long keys, which is crazy. So yeah.
Yes.
But I think that Star Wars is going to do the same thing. I really do.
Well, I mean, there's, you know, I'll put it this way. I can understand Star Wars being around for a long time a lot more than I understood Avatar being around for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
I saw Avatar once and walked out, and there wasn't any sort of, you know, path to acceptance or I've come to love The Force Awakens in its own right. That didn't happen with Avatar. Saw it once and I was like, okay.
I love Avatar. But my opinion of it has definitely declined in the years since, whereas Force Awakens, I still think is pretty great, but I think that regardless, I think Force Awakens is better than Avatar. I would have said that, you know, back in 2008 or whatever it was, 2008, 9.
I don't know.
I think it was. I think it was the same year as Star Trek. Yeah, Star Trek and Glorious Bastards and Avatar. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, Abrams, he, you know, because of that, because he's obviously the maker of Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens, of course they're going to put his name all over the trailer for Star Trek Beyond. Which is attached, you know, to the front of many prints of Star Wars, The Force Awakens. But what does that mean? Because obviously he was busy making Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens. That's why he didn't direct Star Trek Beyond. So we're going to look at that in this series. We're going to look and see, what does it mean? Does it mean anything? I don't know. We'll find out. And to get this ball rolling, we are going to look at the first movie which he produced, which he didn't direct, which is The Pallbearer. The Pallbearer.
The Pallbearer, and I do want to say that I have a bit of a grudge with this, because when we first discussed it, I thought it was possibly a biopic about the Undertaker's manager from the WWF, but it wasn't, and I was very upset about that. So I may have come in with a little chip on my shoulder.
Would David Schwimmer have been a good casting choice to play that pallbearer?
No. But he could have been like the guy who discovered. He couldn't play McMahon because he didn't have the muscle for it. But I could see him playing like some sort of guy who discovered the act and like brought him to McMahon or something like that. That would be an interesting take.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah. Unfortunately, that's not what it is. It's a movie. Which was produced by Jeffrey Abrams. This is how far back we're going. He doesn't even go by JJ yet. And it's pre-Bad Robot. Bad Robot does not come into existence for another 5 years after this. It's 1996. It is written by Matt Reeves and Jason Kadams, and directed by Reeves. Now, Matt Reeves is probably best known to people as the director of Cloverfield, another movie which we're going to be looking at in this series. But prior to that, but after this, prior to Cloverfield, in between the two, he and Abrams co-created the show Felicity. So there's that. Reeves has also gone on to direct Let Me In,
which was the adaptation of the Let the Right One In.
Yes, movie.
But his adaptation was pretty fantastic. I got to admit, I really liked it.
I've never seen either one. I want to.
Oh, the American adaptation is one of the few times where, like, you know, it's really good.
Okay.
You should see it.
All right. And he also did Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. The newest one.
Was that Dawn? Yeah, because it was Rise and then Dawn.
And
yes,
now,
because the next one is War.
War, yeah, which he's also doing. Which he's
yes.
Also doing. Yeah. And Dawn was really good, too. So.
Yeah, it was.
So that's Matt Reeves. Now, Jason Kadams, he is a guy who we've talked about on this show before in regards to Roswell. You know, at this point in time, all he had done was written a few episodes of My So-Called Life. But he would go on to create a number of shows or develop a number of shows which were very successful and popular and considered to be quite good. And those shows include Roswell, Friday Night Lights, which is one of my all-time favorite shows.
I've never seen the show, but I've heard nothing but rave reviews of it.
Yeah, if you're looking for something to watch, yeah, it's on Netflix. Just watch the first episode. You'll be hooked. Okay. You'll be hooked. But yeah.
Oh, all right. Well, I'll check that out then.
Yeah, and it was. He also did Parenthood, the newest version of Parenthood, and About a Boy. And fun fact, Friday Night Lights, Parenthood, and About a Boy, the television shows, all take place in the same continuity, right? So now
they do.
Yes, they do. They do, because there's a character from Parenthood who is in the first episode of About a Boy, but then About a Boy also has webisodes, and one of the characters from Friday Night Lights is in one of the About a Boy webisodes. Okay, but now here's my question. I've always had this question.
Okay.
Each of those shows is adapted from a movie, right? So
yes.
So does that mean that those three movies take place in the same continuity?
Ooh. Oh.
But here, hang on.
You know
hang
what?
Hang on. More complicated.
Okay.
Because two of those, Friday Night Lights and About a Boy, are based on books. So do those take place in the same continuity? And keep in mind that one of those books is nonfiction. So does that mean that About a Boy takes place in our reality?
I don't know what's real anymore. I've given up. You know what? I'm going to take the standard Lucasfilm response to that and say, so long as there is nothing to contradict, yes. Therefore, we are all living in About a Boy continuity?
I think so, yeah.
Well, okay. All right. There's nothing to contradict that, so yes.
Okay, cool.
Yes. It's a documentary.
Yeah. Regardless of any of that, I don't think the Pallbearer takes place in any of those continuities.
I certainly hope not.
So, yeah. Now, there are obviously connections to all these people, but it's kind of interesting that, you know, all of these guys who would go on to have very successful careers in TV and movies would get their start making this little movie, which a lot of people haven't seen, most likely. It came out in 1996, and would you want to give a little synopsis of it?
Yes, David Schwimmer plays a late bloomer who's still living with his mother, who gets called up one day to deliver the eulogy and be pallbearer for a person from high school that has killed themselves that he has no memory of. And along the way, he runs across Gwyneth Paltrow, who plays Julie, who was his high school crush that he's, I guess, by default, still in love with.
Yes, and basically he can't get out of the lie. He starts off feeling sort of bad for the mom of this kid who died.
Yeah, and that's a plot line that goes in a strange way.
Right, and basically the big conflict in the movie comes from the fact that he ends up sleeping with the mom, and at the same time, you know, maintaining his crush for Gwyneth Paltrow. So it's like a weird love triangle sort of thing.
I would say stalking, actually.
Okay, stalking.
Because he parks a street away from her record store and with binoculars monitors her on what appears to be at least every couple of days sort of basis.
Yeah.
And then in between he goes and has various booty calls with the mother of the guy he doesn't remember.
Yeah, I guess that would be stalking. Yeah.
It's not what one should do if one is well-adjusted. I'll just put it that way.
You're probably right. Yes, yes, you're probably right. So what did you think about this thing?
it's awful. It is. Usually I couch things and I try to state it politically. I fell asleep three times trying to watch this. It's an hour and 37 minutes. I was not particularly tired. I started watching it like 5:30. I was like, all right, hon, I want to go watch this movie. I fell asleep within 15 minutes. Okay. This movie doesn't know whether it wants to be a comedy, whether it wants to be a riff on The Graduate, whether it wants to be like a romantic drama. It doesn't know what it wants to be. It's all over the board. And on top of all of that, the main character is not sympathetic at all. He is not sympathetic, and his friends are even less sympathetic. Michael Rapaport phones in somebody that should not just not be anybody's friend. He should be on their hit list. And the woman who plays his wife, I mean, she did a fine job, because if I was supposed to hate her by the end of the movie, hey, mission accomplished.
Which you were. Like, she's supposed to be unlikable, right?
But it's basically like a really bad sitcom pilot gone amok. I that's all I can say about it.
Just to give you sort of an idea of whether or not we're on the same page, for anyone who's just listened to what John has to say, I'm going to read you word for word the notes which I have jotted down for this.
Oh boy.
It's a mess. Doesn't know what it is trying to be. Obviously heavily influenced by The Graduate, but without any of that movie's admirable traits.
Yes.
Tonally disastrous. So
I feel like we made a World Series allusion a couple of episodes ago. I feel like we're firing on all cylinders right here.
Yeah.
You and me, we are finally right there. We're in the zone, man.
Yeah.
Right alongside.
Yeah.
Excellent.
It is kind of crazy. I mean, going into it, I guess I just assumed from, like, the box art, you know, like, oh, this is going to be sort of a romantic comedy, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
I was kind of guessing that it would have sort of like a Woody Allen vibe, but it doesn't. It's almost as if they were trying to do, like, The Graduate, but seriously, like, not as a comedy, but it lacks all of the substance and all of the heavy sort of like drama and weight that The Graduate has, sort of,
or
spite of being
charm.
A comedy. Yeah. And even the charm.
Because I mean, honestly, that's, you know, that's Dustin Hoffman in his prime. Even Buck Henry in The Graduate is fantastic. Like he's barely there, but he's great.
Oh, Buck Henry's great in everything.
Well, that's true. I had, you know, real quick sidetrack. I had the pleasure of seeing him on Broadway one time.
Oh, really?
He's just as fantastic live. He really is.
Yeah, he's great, and his writing is great too. I mean,
yeah,
obviously The Graduate. But have you seen To Die For?
No, I haven't seen that.
Oh, you gotta see it. And he's in that too. He plays a school teacher in that, just a little cameo kind of thing. But
okay,
he's
I will add that to the list.
Directed by Gus Van Sant, starring Nicole Kidman in one of her best roles. And first R-rated movie I ever snuck into, by the way. So,
oh, very cool.
Yeah,
mine was Die Hard, but hey.
Oh, you beat me.
But, okay. I would love to like find anything to glean positive from this. The one thing that I can say is that what it serves as is a time capsule reminder that there was a time when Gwyneth Paltrow did not command the respect that she mysteriously does now, because this is before Shakespeare in Love, and post Shakespeare in Love, it was like Gwyneth Paltrow, actress. This is back when she was still like on that sort of shaky romantic comedy, Jennifer Aniston-y sort of ground. So I think that it's an historical curio for that reason.
Let me just read to you the last sentence that I have written down here. Interesting to see a movie from that era, cast especially.
There you go. There you go.
But, I mean, it's true. Okay, because, like, I don't know. There's a thing about this time period where it's like, I find it particularly fascinating. Because this is like when I was starting to get super hardcore into movies. 1996 was like the first summer where I was like, I'm going to see everything, like every single movie that comes out. And I wasn't, well, for one thing, I wasn't 17 yet, so I couldn't get into all the R-rated movies, especially the art house ones, because the theater that played the art house movies would card people, whereas the theater that played the blockbusters would not card people. So I could get into all the R-rated blockbusters, but I couldn't get into something, well, Paul Bearer, I think, was rated PG-13. But because of that, there's a lot of smaller movies like this, which are from that era, which I am not aware of. Whereas, you know, even like 3 years later, I'm aware of like everything. I've probably seen everything. But here I've seen like a good chunk, but there's some like this where it's like, wait a minute. Okay, this is like, it's starring David Schwimmer and Gwyneth Paltrow and all these people, you know, Toni Collette and Michael Vartan, who Abrams would work with on Alias, you know, as just a little baby. And Greg Grunberg shows up, of course, you know.
Well, I think it's a law. I don't know.
But because of that, it's like this weird, I'm not going to say gem, but this weird mineral. Which is in the ground, which I didn't know existed, you know? And it's like, oh, look, there's a, I didn't know that that thing was there. And it just sort of like adds to the tapestry of the movie landscape of that time period or whatever, you know what I mean? And, and like seeing, you know, hearing like, well, seeing that it's a Miramax production starring David Schwimmer and Gwyneth Paltrow and a lot of these other people who would go on to become bigger stars, if not big stars, but certainly bigger stars. And then you hear things like, you know, Kevin Smith talk about how, like, right around the time that this movie came out, he was making Chasing Amy at Miramax, and Miramax was trying to, as he describes it, at that point, Miramax was really interested in making stars. They wanted, they found talent, and they were making movies like The Pallbearer as vehicles for people like David Schwimmer and Gwyneth Paltrow in the hopes of making them big and turning them into box office gold. And like he talks about how with Chasing Amy, the Miramax was going to give them a couple million dollars if he had cast David Schwimmer, Jon Stewart, and Drew Barrymore.
Oh my God. Okay, yeah. There are a lot. You, anybody that's listened to me chatter with you knows that if Kevin Smith ever runs across me, he's probably going to punch me in the face. But
no, he won't, because he's cool like that.
Yeah, it's probably too stoned. He'd probably swing and miss. But the like the first three movies he did were great. I can't tell you how happy I am that he did not cast those people in Chasing Amy. Because I remember seeing that movie. I haven't seen it since because that's one of those ones where I loved it so much that I'm like, I don't want to go back and revisit it in case I don't like. Like, I want to preserve the memory.
Interesting.
Basically.
Yeah.
Like, Saving Private Ryan's like that. Like, I don't want to experience that beginning again if it's not on a big screen because I don't want to lose what it felt like. You know, I don't want to have anything to compare it to.
Yeah.
And Chasing Amy, like, my goodness, how different is that movie if he had cast those people? Like, that is fascinating to me.
The funny thing is, like, Schwimmer and Barrymore were already well on their way to becoming stars. Jon Stewart did end up in some Miramax movies like The Faculty and stuff, but he obviously became huge doing something else.
Yeah. But The Faculty was Dimension, wasn't it? Because that was a Miramax subsidiary?
Yeah, well, basically, it was all the same. Like, Bob Weinstein ran Dimension and Harvey ran Miramax. But basically, it was just sort of like a brand offshoot, kind of like Marvel or whatever, you know.
Right. Okay.
But, you know, the three people who did end up in Chasing Amy, well, Joey Lauren Adams, unfortunately and inexplicably, has not become a star, which is, I don't understand how that happens. But the other two are Jason Lee and Ben Affleck, who had come out of nowhere. And those two people, who obviously were not on, you know, Weinstein's radar at all, are huge stars now. Batman, you're talking about Batman and Earl, right? I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, no, but wasn't... Okay, I know we've gone down the Chasing Amy rabbit hole here, but...
Which is fine.
Is it... Like, Ben Affleck, Mallrats versus Chasing Amy, I seem to recall Affleck calling it out, that you can tell a difference in him because Michael Bay had discovered him and had cast him for Armageddon and was starting to, like, get him in shape. Like, he looks different between those two movies.
It wasn't until after Chasing Amy, I think. I think maybe that was between Chasing Amy and Dogma, because I know, like, in Chasing Amy, he talks about how, like, he had to wear his own clothes. He was living on Kevin Smith's couch and everything. But then, like, before Chasing Amy came out, I think they had already started shooting Armageddon because,
So he was living on Kevin Smith's couch.
Yeah.
I would have figured it would have been Matt Damon's. Okay.
No, well, while they were shooting the movie, anyway.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm sure Matt Damon, you know, this was pre, you know, I mean, like, we're getting into, like, the history of Miramax now from that era, which is fascinating and you know, relevant to the pallbearer and I'm sure more interesting, but, like, Good Will Hunting would have never been made if it weren't for Chasing Amy because Miramax was getting ready, or I'm sorry, it was set up at Sony, and Sony was getting ready to dump it because they wanted to shoot it in Toronto, and Damon and Affleck were violently opposed to that, and basically Sony said, like, you have, like, a week to find someone else to buy the script from you or else we're shooting it in Toronto. And he was like, this is while they were shooting Chasing Amy. And Affleck was, like, all depressed, and Kevin Smith is like, what's going on? And Affleck told him, and Smith was like, well, give me the script, I'll read it. If I like it, I'll give it to Harvey Weinstein. And he did, and Smith is like, oh, my God, this is amazing, handed it to Weinstein, and Weinstein bought it on the spot, and the rest is history. That's why Kevin Smith is, that's why Kevin Smith is an executive producer on Good Will Hunting, because he's the guy who got it in Miramax.
Fine, I'll say another good thing about Kevin Smith then.
And actually, they offered it to Kevin Smith to direct, and he turned it down because he didn't think he was capable, which is interesting.
I would say that that's another positive thing to say about Kevin Smith is he knows his limits.
And good, it was directed by Gus Van Sant, who directed To Die For, which was written by Buck Henry, who wrote The Graduate, which was ripped off by these guys to make Paul Bear. Anyway...
So we're in the pallbearer cinematic continuity now, right?
Yeah, I think so.
All right.
I think so.
There you go.
All right. So back to pallbearer. Yeah. I mean, it is kind of interesting to see these things set up in, like, Gwyneth Paltrow, like you're saying, like, this is the same year that she made Hard Eight, Sydney, Paul Thomas Anderson's first movie.
Oh, my gosh. That's right.
And even though it's, like, a completely different role and a completely different movie, like, I'm watching it and I'm like, you see things that she's doing. There's, like, shots and movements and, you know, like, little sort of, like, actor tics that she has, which you can see in both movies. And it's like, wow, you know, and you don't see it later on in her career. You don't see it in Iron Man, you know, or anything like that. And I think that's really interesting and really cool. And, stuff like that I find fascinating about this movie. Everything else... not so much.
The one thing is, like, you know, Barbara Hershey, I think, tried really hard to sort of carry this one. Mm-hmm. Like, I very much get the feeling that this was, when they brought her on, it was like, okay, this can be a vehicle to breathe some new life in your career. And maybe, like, a way to sell you is, like, a reinvigorated Oscar contender sort of actress. Like, that's just the vibe I got through the entire thing. So I think she actually tried. Like, I think that she was just a victim of, I mean, honestly, the script.
Yeah.
But I think she did the best that she could with what was there. Insofar as, like, she was actually sympathetic. Although, like, I don't know. I don't know whether she was meaning to play it a little bit unstable to begin with. I mean, I guess so, considering the circumstances and everything.
Yeah.
But... she's one of those performances where it's like, it's not great, it's not stellar, but you can tell that if she'd had just a little more material to work with,
mm-hmm.
she could have turned it into something. So I'll give that positive note to it.
Yeah, I mean, the performances, I don't think any of the performances are tremendously bad. I just think that the script is terrible. You know, I mean, that's the thing. It's strange because... like, I saw, you know, I mean, I am a fan of Matthew Reeves based on his other stuff. And because of that, I was, like, excited to watch this movie. And then when I saw that he co-wrote it with Kadams, I'm like, oh, yeah. Because, I mean, Roswell is great. Parenthood is great. Friday Night Lights, though, is like one of the best shows I've ever seen. You know, the writing on it in particular is some of the best writing I've ever seen. So if you say Jason Katims wrote a movie, I'm like, I'm there. Let's watch this, you know.
But wouldn't that be indicative? I mean, especially considering this sort of feels like a sitcom plot gone monstrously wrong. Like, is it possible that like that's just an indication that his best medium in which to work is television?
Yeah, and that could be.
He just isn't suited to this sort of environment, which is not a knock. Everybody's got their strengths.
Yeah, I mean that could so, be. That could be for yeah. sure. Yeah, I don't know. Okay, now. There was one other collaborator on this movie who has worked in Star Trek, and he worked in Star Trek on a minor role, but it was at the beginning of his career, and he's since blown up to become a huge leader in his field, and that's the cinematographer Robert Elswit, who also shot Hard Eight, by the way. So that was sort of another layer to that Gwyneth Paltrow thing,
because oh, really?
It was like lit the same way and everything from the same time period. But back in the day, when he was getting started off in this industry, he was a, I guess he worked in the camera department, you know, as like a camera operator and stuff like that for visual effects companies. He had worked on Empire and Jedi for ILM, but back before that, he worked for Apogee, the company that did visual effects for Star Trek the Motion Picture, or one of the companies that did visual effects for Star Trek the Motion Picture, and he worked on that movie. That was like one of his first jobs in the industry. So, you know, and I always, you know, I get a kick when I'm watching, well, any old movie, especially like any old, like big budget blockbuster from like the 80s or whatever, and you look in those credits and buried deep, you'll find names like David Fincher or whatever doing like matte yeah. paintings on Return of right. the Jedi, you know, that kind of thing. And Robert Elswit is one of those names buried in the credits for Star Trek the Motion Picture. And he, you know, has been working as a cinematographer for years and years and years. This was, I guess, one of his very early movies, all things considered. And he has since gone on to do many, many awesome movies, including all of Paul Thomas Anderson's early movies, including Hard Eight and Boogie Nights and Magnolia. I mean, some of the best movies ever made. He's worked yeah. with George Clooney a whole bunch, both as Clooney's cinematographer personally, but also on like George Clooney Productions. And he was nominated for Clooney's Good Night and Good Luck, which is a fantastic movie, by the way, and a fantastic looking movie.
Well, and it was black and white, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
It looked okay. See, because that's yeah. Okay, I do have to see that. But a cinematographer who can work in black and white nowadays is
yeah,
really, you know, a rarity.
It was so good. And fun fact, they printed that movie on black and white film, which is a rarity these. Well, it's non-existent these days, but it was a rarity back in 2006 or 2005 or whatever it was.
Oh wow, so they actually printed it on black and white. Wow, that's so they never oh wow, so that's really cool.
Yeah, like
it must
like,
look fantastic.
Yeah, like Man Who Wasn't There was printed on color film even though it was black and white, and they were like, don't, if you get multiple prints, don't mix up the reels because the tinting might be off a little bit, you know. We've matched them so that they all have like the same tint. But with this, it's like black and white. But it came with its own set of problems because it's like this stuff it absorbs a lot of heat. So if you're yeah. not careful, you will burn this print. You will just burn it. So, you know, you had to be really careful with it. But the contrast and everything was just amazing on it.
You know? Can't wait to see it then.
Yeah. And He also won an Oscar. He was nominated for that. He won for Paul Thomas Anderson's There Will Be Blood, which is obviously...
Oh, yeah. Okay, that movie looks fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
And yes, Daniel Day-Lewis... Without Daniel Day-Lewis, that movie isn't what it is. But the movie looks beautiful. Yeah, he's... Wow, that does make that very interesting that he shot this.
Yeah,
that's really interesting.
And we're going to see some of his work coming up later on in this series because he also photographed the last two Mission Impossible movies. So we'll get to see that coming up in a few weeks, which is exciting. Cool. He's one of my favorites, I have to say. All right. So to wrap this up, looking at it sort of through the J.J. Abrams perspective, I know it's hard since this is the first one, you know, to see, but I think that we can see certain Abrams trademarks more than anything sort of like in the people who he's working with. He's not directly involved, I'm assuming, with any of this stuff. But at the same time, I think he was the biggest name at the time because he had written a lot of movies on his own, like regarding Henry and stuff like that. So he had an in to the industry. Considering the fact that he's worked with a lot of these people numerous times, I'm guessing that he's friends with them. And they wanted to make this movie, and he helped them. That's my guess as to how this all went down. But we are starting to see relationships form with Matt Reeves, Michael Vartan, and Robert Elswit, and, Greg Grunberg is just there, of course, because he's Greg Grunberg, right? I mean, that's what he does.
He's his Ben Affleck.
Exactly, yeah. I love it. On the commentary for Mission Impossible 3, they talk about, it's like him, it's Abrams and Tom Cruise, and they talk about the party in the opening scene, and the house that they used, it was a set, but it was designed to look like J.J. Abrams' house. And
kind of creepy.
Yeah, yeah. But they're like, yeah, this is like his house. And Tom Cruise is like, yeah. And there's Greg Grunberg, you know, which, if you go to J.J. Abrams' house, Greg Grunberg will be standing in his living room. So it's just like J.J. Abrams' house.
That's awesome.
Yep, yep.
That's awesome.
All right. Any final thoughts on The Pallbearer?
Save yourself. Don't watch it.
Yeah, I would say any of these movies which we've talked about, which aren't The Pallbearer, watch any of those instead. Watch The Graduate.
Yes. Yeah. Watch There Will Be Blood.
Watch Chasing Amy. Yeah. Any of those things. To Die For. Any of those. All good choices. All better choices than The Pallbearer. Well, it's been fun talking about The Pallbearer today, but that's not all we're talking about on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at some of the other shows you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Orb.
He requested, you know, a Bajoran officer to serve with him
on
purpose. You know, he understands. You make this their own. We can't.
I'm glad
just...
he did it on purpose. I could see him like accidentally requesting a Bajoran officer. Oh man, I checked the wrong box on the form. Damn.
The Ready Room.
Actually, I think at this point, Vulcan Love Slave was probably just a short story, right? It hadn't been turned into a full-blown
That's right. It's not a full-blown novel at that point. Yeah.
It's just fanfic. It's just fanfic.
Yeah, just fanfic.
Just on the internet. People started writing after First Contact there in Montana.
To the journey! It's a very much the genesis of Seven of Nine.
Genesis alone is not. Sorry.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
The fact that this came out right in between Ocean's 11 and Ocean's 12, where you've got filmmakers who are at the very tip-top of their game.
Oh boy, here comes the Soderbergh speech, everybody. Strap yourselves in, we're going to Soderbergh.
The 602 Club.
But I mean, we talk about the ending and we're sort of dancing around it here. I have to know, because when this book first came out, and every time I look at the cover, I'm reminded of this. This is the first time I can consciously remember a piece of artwork having to do with the story spoiling the ending for me.
Literary Treks.
Just so many great lessons here about, look, life is not safe, but it's good.
Oh, absolutely.
If you can get through it, you know, and bind together with those people around you and go through it together. That's how you make it, is together.
Women at Warp.
She's the communications officer first. She can be Spock's girlfriend second.
So how do you think people would respond if you said, describe who Carol Marcus is after seeing this movie.
She looks nice in her bra.
Meta tricks.
I looked it up, and ornare is the Latin word for to adorn.
That's fascinating.
So I looked up breca, and it turns out the same spelling, B-R-E-K-K-A, is Old Norse for slope or hillside.
And that, listeners, is something you will only get right here on Metatrex.
Better living through etymology.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. And beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another show which isn't mentioned there, which we should probably mention because, hey, it just started and, hey, we were on 5 episodes this past week, is From There to Here, where we're doing a 50th anniversary rewatch of all 729 episodes of Star Trek as a network. It's coming out every day. We're doing 2 episodes a day. Each episode is only like, each show is only like 15 minutes long. And we are just starting with Enterprise and working our way through the timeline all the way up, and then we'll end with Star Trek Beyond on December 31st. And to get the ball rolling, John and I recorded the first 5 episodes, all of which are out now. We've got more episodes coming out every day with new hosts, you know, for each block.
That's the coolest part, is that we're mixing it up. Like, yes, me and Mike started, but like, there's going to be a mix of different hosts, like with their takes on everything. So I'm looking forward to the series just because it's going to be a lot of fun just to hear everybody's different approach to everything. You know, like we're all playing in the same sandbox now. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Right now, the block, which is currently going on today's episode, features Will Wynn from Warp 5 and Brandon Matala, who's new to the network, but you'll be hearing a lot more of him in the future. Yep. And check it out. It's called From There to Here, and you'll find it right here on Trek FM. All right. If you want to help us out keeping this network running, you can buy some of our stuff. If you go to trek.fm/store, that'll take you to our Redbubble store page, where you can buy t-shirts and sweatshirts and stickers and notebooks and everything with various Trek FM artwork on it. And that helps us keep this thing running. So check that out.
And it's very well-designed stuff. And the sweatshirts are very comfortable.
They are.
They really are.
I'm wearing my Maroon Monster shirt right now.
It looks great. The artwork for these things is just out of the park. It's great.
Yep. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you want to contact us, you can fill out the form on trek.fm/contact, or you can leave us a voicemail on speakpipe.com/trekfm. You can find the network on Twitter at trekfm, or you can find the network on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. You can also find the Babel Conference on Facebook. That's our user forum, our listener forum. I always say user. It's listeners, right? Whatever.
Yes,
I guess
listeners.
Listeners are using our, whatever. It's our listener forum. Just type the Babel Conference into the search field on Facebook. That's B-A-B-E-L. Or go to our website at trek.fm and click the discussion tab on the menu bar. All right. Before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor, who helps us bring commentary, Trek Stars, and all of our shows to you each week. And our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have the time for. John, What book do you have for us this week?
Well, keeping with the theme of the pallbearer, we have Mortuary Confidential, Undertakers Spill the Dirt, written by Kenneth McKenzie and Todd Hara, narrated by Susan Larkin and Alan Robertson. In this macabre and moving compilation, funeral directors across the country share their most embarrassing, jaw-dropping, irreverent, and deeply poignant stories about life at death's door. Discover what scares them and what moves them to tears. Learn about rookie mistakes and why death sometimes calls for duct tape. Enjoy tales of the dearly departed spending eternity naked from the waist down and getting bottled and corked in a wine bottle.
Yeah, you know, I have, I think there have been a number of people in my family who have been morticians, most notably, mainly because of his name, my uncle Maury, Maury the Mortician.
That works.
And I never met him, unfortunately, because he was long gone by the time that I was born. But, you know, there's a history of that in my family. I don't know, everyone, my mom, she makes a living, you know, performing music at funerals. It's I've been
the strange thing being that it's upbeat music.
it's whatever they want, whatever they want. Usually it's not. Usually it's like Amazing Grace and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But you know, whatever they want, within reason, you know. But yeah, I'm fascinated by morticians.
I would have to say that. You have to have a pretty good sense of humor to work as a mortician, I believe.
Yeah.
Like you would really have to be able to, I mean, think about what you're doing every day. I think I am going to download this and listen to it because I got to hear some of these stories.
All right. Well, as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice, including this one, along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank Audible for supporting Commentary, Trek Stars, and the network. I just finished a book on Audible that was recommended to me by some other people here on the network. Yeah. It's called Weapon of a Jedi.
They steered you right, Mike.
Nope.
They steered you right, Mike.
It's not a good book. I don't know what you want me to say. It's not a good book.
I want you to say it is a good book.
Why would I say that?
That's what I want you to say.
Why would I say that?
But I also want you to be honest. So, okay. You're allowed not to like it, Mike.
Thanks.
It's okay.
Thanks. It's not good. It's better than the pallbearer, though. So,
setting the bar kind of low there, Mike.
You kind of have to. All right. Well, that's it for the pallbearer. That's it for this week. We will be back next week with the second movie that J.J. Abrams produced that he didn't direct. Actually, the second movie that he produced, period. The Suburbans.